I'm Dean Jackson. He's Joe Polish. And this is the I Love Marketing Podcast.
Hey, everybody, it's Dean Jackson
and Joe Polish, and, you know, this is going to be a pretty awesome episode of I Love Marketing. I would even venture to say one of the best ever, because we have
a special guest.
Yeah, we got a special guest who, if you've not heard of him, I'll say who it is in just a moment, this man is responsible for not only probably billions of dollars in sales generation, but he has probably spawned an entire world of some of the greatest marketers and consultants on the planet, and has been instrumental in a lot of the learning that me and Dean have been involved in over the years. And his name is Mr. Jay Abraham. So, Jay, it's great to finally have you as a guest on I Love Marketing. How are you?
I'm good, and it's very gracious, and thank you. It's a little humbling, and it's my pleasure to be here. So, you know, have at me. I'm going to try to be a best
have at me.
Value
I love
creation.
That.
Well, yeah. Prior to us starting to record, you know, Jay, we've had no questions that he's seen, or he doesn't know what we're even going to ask him. But you know, Jay has just done a lot of stuff, and I kind of have a list of some of the things you've done. You're a best-selling author. You've popularized the phrase "unique selling proposition." You created the strategy of preeminence. You're known as the world's leading marketing authority. You have specialties in marketing and business growth and copywriting and sales methodology and joint ventures and leveraging other people's resources and on and on and on and on. So, how many years you've been doing this, for one? I want to ask you that first, and then I want to kind of get some background on who you are for people that may not know who Jay Abraham is.
I've been doing it indirectly since I was 18. I'm 64, and my math is not as adroit as yours, but many years, 30-some years.
Well, I don't know if my math being adroit, but you have one of the most expansive vocabularies of probably anyone that I've ever met. So,
there's a reason for it. There's a reason for it. And I'll tell you what it is.
What is that?
When I was young, it was very important to me to be a precise communicator. Every day, and I have a very humble background, every day I would take five words out of a thesaurus and I would use each word appropriately, at least as appropriate as I could, knowing I didn't know what I was talking about, at least 20 times a day. And I was able to build a reasonably, not articulate, but precise vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that is kind of one of your hallmarks. That's one of the things that people recognize you for. And I've always thought that too, that the precision of the language that you use, because you're always pulling out the right word. And words make a difference.
Yeah,
I remember years ago, this must have been 15 years ago, I'm listening to some cassette tapes, some Jay Abraham cassette tapes, and he said the word engineered reciprocity. And I never heard that before, and I never forgot it, because I was like, he's got just hundreds of things like that that he will say to explain things, but you're very good. I think one of the best in the world at taking marketing concepts and explaining them in ways so that people can understand them and apply them. You're not only very strategic, but you're very, very tactical. And, so who is Jay Abraham? I mean, looking back at your career, how do you explain who you are and what you do?
I was watching a movie a couple of months ago, and it really explained me. It was not a great movie, but it was a man who they were chronicling who was very successful. Not talking about that, but he could constantly tell people he was hopelessly curious. Hopelessly curious. My life has been denominated by the fact that I was bored, and so I wanted to learn constantly about as many things and as many industries and as many applications and how everything worked. And after enough years, it all congealed and converged, and I realized that there was so much that people in one industry didn't understand about possibilities, but I was hopelessly curious.
You know, I think I'm kind of hopelessly curious, and hopelessly because I've gotten myself into some really crazy situations. But, you know, I think there's a lot to be I mean, there's truly so much going on in the world, and to me, it's fascinating. And all of
and let's just say this, though, that your hopeless curiosity, you're going to look like a genius in 50 years when all this space stuff takes off, because you're poised for success in the space everything industry.
That's well, yeah, you know, I don't even know if Jay knows this, but, you know, Jay, I own the website, which soon we'll be doing something with, spacemarketing.com, spaceadvertising.com. I even own spaceuniversity.com.
Wow.
And, you know, I'm very involved with Peter Diamandis. I'm a platinum partner at Singularity University. Ray Kurzweil is a friend of mine. I'm Richard Branson's largest fundraiser. I'm around all these people that are in the space industry. I'm an investor in an asteroid mining company. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy stuff going on. And, you know, I'm getting ready for when space travel becomes available, which will happen very soon. You know, there's going to be a whole industry that's going to be brought up. I'm going to take all this fancy, effective, I shouldn't even say fancy. That's probably not the right word for direct response. But I'm going to take all this knowledge I have of direct response
marketing and repurpose it. That'll be fabulous.
Exactly. So you know, you've done so much. I mean, what are you most proud of in your life? Because you've had some enormous accomplishments. I mean, if we just talked about success stories, we could spend 2 weeks just on the success stories alone.
I'll tell you what I think in reflection, because as you get older, you look at what your legacy is. I mean, when you're younger, you look at making money and you look. But I think that I'm, again, proudest, most proud, reflectively, that I helped deserving people who didn't know how to fully communicate their extraordinary levels of value and contribution connect with the people who benefited the most. And as I got older and more clear in my not just my vision, but my understanding of the powers and the forces, I was able to create things like preeminence, and I was able to understand how to harness it. And I think I'm probably, of all the things I've done, I mean, I'm not trying to be arrogant. I've done a lot of stuff with 465 industries all over the world. But I think that the people that I've been able to stimulate to achieve and contribute at a higher strata of value creation for their market is what I'm probably the most proud of.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, you know, in my observation of it, one of the things that always struck me that is a kind of a common theme is that you always seem to act as sort of an ombudsman between the clients and the companies providing the benefit, that you're always helping the companies see it from the client's perspective. And I think that you, more than anybody, that in my observation, has really kind of introduced this idea of really falling in love with your clients. I mean, it all does really come from love, is what it feels like.
And it is, but I've been benefited, and it will take more than an hour, probably take a day to explain all the magnificent and benevolent mentors who took me under their wing and the aggregate sort of a new worldview that they gave me. But from the very beginning, truthfully, and it was like a default naturally, I can't tell you that why and how and what influence, but I always saw when I had clients, the business was not who I saw as my client. I was almost sometimes, you know, transparently through them. I always was the advocate, of their market. I was always the champion of the prospect or the underserved. Mm-hmm. And that was inherent in my thinking sort of naturally, but it evolved as I could, you know, sometimes you have intuitive understanding, but it's not crystallized and it's not, you know, it's not verbalized and it's not really codified. The more you get, like, maybe mature and deeply reflect on it, the more you understand. It's like maybe, you know, having oil but not knowing what to do with it, or electricity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned mentors. I'm curious, like, who are or were your mentors, and what are the most important lessons you learned from them? If you could just pick.
I had mentors. My mentors were of two kinds. Because of my curiosity, I was able to stimulate a sense of openness and collaborative sort of, I'm going to use the word revelator, where people would reveal themselves at a very deep, honest, and intimate, not sexually intimate, but intellectually and heartfelt intimacy. But, you know, the guy that I worked for when I did Icy Hot taught me to look at life differently. A guy that I worked with when I was in the dry cleaning business taught me to look at life in a whole different way. A guy, you know, Claude Hopkins vicariously was dead, but I met Dan Rosenthal many years ago. And Dan Rosenthal, who anybody, and you should interview him if you can find him. I don't know if you have or not, but just brilliant mind. But he taught me not only to study people from the 20s and 30s when they didn't have the ability to use technology or sexuality or graphics. They had to understand pure, unadulterated human psychology and enduring, immutable facets of the human condition. And he taught me not only to read Claude Hopkins, but he forced me to read, first of all, Claude Hopkins' philosophies, scientific advertising. Then he forced me to read My Life in Advertising so I could understand the context of what the man experienced to formulate his beliefs. And then he forced me to read, not forced in a negative, but he really compelled me to then read Taken at the Flood, which is the life of Albert Lasker, who employed Claude Hopkins. And it gave me a really interesting, I've just been blessed by people. You know, I work for the Deming organization. I work with the world's largest multivariable testing organization. I worked with the world's largest strategic litigation, and they had 160 PhD psychologists and sociologists. I've been blessed by a lot of people. I've worked with 300 experts, none of which came to me for help with their methodology, but they all came for me to help them, you know, command premium or differentiate or preempt. But I had to learn all of their methodology, at least at a lay level, so I could advocate and distinguish and contrast. So I got educated by everybody in order, sort of like an attorney that's going into a new field that you pay for the privilege of getting educated. I mean, I had that all my life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so why marketing? I mean, why do you love marketing? I mean, we're on I Love Marketing. It seems like, why this area?
Because marketing is the ultimate, it's an integration of education, of fulfilling non-verbalized needs. It's transformative, because if your product or service is really superior value creation, you're adding a degree of benefit, enhancement, protection to people's lives. It's very rare in a life you get a chance to transform enormous quantities of people and thinking by me being able to instill and install preeminence or strategy instead of being tactical or value added or risk reversal to somebody who ran a business. I was able to help them influence tens of thousands of people and the people, their children. And it's probably intellectually arrogant and selfish. It gives me a forum and a chance to be sitting here in my, you know, basement in my shorts talking to you and know that I've had the aggregate, you know, geometric influence on millions and millions of people who are not just theoretical, but they're contributing and adding value and transforming. And if you've never done that, it's a very, very fulfilling and a very, very satisfying thing. And it's probably better than drugs and probably better than sex. It's a very satisfying intellectual thing to do.
Mm.
I don't know if that answer is good, but it's
no. I think it's a great answer. And I mean, to me, Mark, I created this video. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but I have this 3-minute and 50-second video called "Is Selling Evil."
You did say. I think you sent it to me. Yeah, you sent it to me, and I watched it. I thought it was good. It was very impressive.
Yeah, you know, I talk. I, it's like a you know, it's being a champion for marketers, because they get really misinterpreted by a lot of people. And certainly there are people that use marketing in malicious ways and, you know, sell crap and, you know, all under the guise of marketing. But, you know, real, I always
that goes to intent and ethos, and that's a whole different discussion, which we can get into. But it's, I mean, it's a powerful force. It can be used for extraordinary good, and it can be used for extraordinary bad. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about power and forces and things like that. If you understand them, is either you harness them for a purpose, or they sort of consume you. It's very interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, I always love the comparison that marketing is to a business what oxygen is to a human body. I mean, it's that important. And let me ask you about, why do you think the public is so apt to think or talk negatively or talk down about marketers, as if they're some sort of, you know, nuisance or pest, or in worst cases, like they're designed to just take advantage of them and manipulate them and screw them over? Why do you think that exists?
I think it's because of abuse and misuse of power, of the power of marketing. I mean, they don't down. They usually don't talk down about Apple.
Right.
They're pretty good marketers. You know, I mm-hmm. think it depends on your intention, your attention to the market. And I think that most people, I mean, I was involved. I mean, I've been involved in so many activities. I was involved in the infomercial market when it first started. At that point, it was so powerful that it didn't matter intention. People who were scammy, who were totally, totally impervious to even caring about value, made fortunes because the market trusted. I was involved in the information marketing before probably most anybody that's not older than I am. And I've seen rapscallions, infidels, terribly, terribly poor intended people capitalize. And I think that when you get a power that you don't use for ultimate elevated good, you create your own. I mean, I think it's a tragedy, because I think marketing is the ultimate. It's the, and let me think if I can say this right, you're challenging me to think about things from a vantage point I haven't for a long, long time. I think marketing is the most powerful agent of, and we can fill in the blank, goodness or badness, you know, contribution, or we have it's not original to me, but we were impacted by a friend of mine who says, in life, you're either a multiplier or a diminisher. You either take a situation and make it great, take people and make them great, take situations and make them, exquisite, sublime, or you destroy them, you consume them, you devour them. And I think that, I mean, I'm giving you perhaps an esoteric, intellectualized answer, but I think that it's because people who got the power too young, I mean, in the beginning of the internet, there's so many young Turks that didn't really deserve to make the money they did. And they abused, and I'll tell you a story, and it's from my past, but it's a very good indicator. One of my many, many, many multitudes of jobs when I was young was selling radio advertising. And I was naive and trusting and theoretically ignorant. And I was very good because of my zeal and enthusiasm in selling companies and retailers and doctors who'd never, ever used radio. And I believed in my delusionary optimism that our radio station, a 60-second commercial, could transform and enhance the success of these businesses. And they believed my deluded belief. And to add even one more level of stupidity and embarrassment, I sold people who did not have agencies. And we had in our radio station an in-house copywriter whose claim to fame was that he could write a 60-second commercial in 60 seconds. I didn't know what injustice and what disservice I was invoking on people. I would get people to advertise who never did because they believed me, and they'd lose all their money, their $2,000 or $5,000. And I realized I didn't just lose their $2,000. I lost their faith in the medium and maybe their faith in advertising forever. But I think that's, I don't get too you know, tangential, but I don't know if that answers you or not.
No, I mean, yeah, I think it answers it very well. It's caused me to really think about it, because that's something that I think about a lot. And I think of any group of people that are enormously skilled that I think are not only undervalued, if even identified, but they're treated with large levels of disrespect, simply because, you know, what people are not up on, they're down on. And if they had a bad experience with a quote-unquote marketer, you know, they all of a sudden attack the entire subject matter. And, you know, it's funny because I've seen, you know, very skilled marketers, and I would put myself in this category, that have spent years, you know, learning what it is that they know. And someone would go to, you know, a doctor in a particular, or a dentist, and they would not question what the dentist is recommending because he's quote-unquote a dentist. But I've, you know, everyone seems to have an opinion on how to do marketing or how not to do it, and they have no basis. So I see so much incompetence and so much judgment that comes out of the field. So I'm always, you know, I'm always curious if it's even worth trying to change people's minds.
But there's another side, and there's a bigger, there's a duality of tragedy. One is the power is used for the wrong way. The other is there could be such really quality, deserving people that have such a superior product, service, concern, commitment, integrated value proposition, but they do not know how to differentiate. They do not know how to communicate. They do not know how to delineate. They do not know how to demonstrate. And so forever, you know, they're mediocre, but that's as big a tragedy, don't you think?
Oh yeah, completely, completely. And I mean, that's who I think we exist for, and that's the real value of someone that embraces it and understands it. And a lot of times people learn about, you know, when I would say direct response and the type of marketing we teach by accident. I mean, I stumbled upon the right type of marketing. I mean, I was, you know my story. I was a dead broke carpet cleaner,
yeah,
living off credit cards, and I learned marketing never thinking I would teach it or write courses on it or do what I do today. I learned it because I needed business. I needed to survive, and it was a means to an end. But I fell in love with the fact that you can change the message on a piece of paper and it would dramatically, you know, increase response. And to me, that was fascinating that you could replicate the process of selling through.
Well, I got not just enlightened, but or smitten. I got hopelessly impassioned with the power of qualitative marketing, because I had the chance to look at about $500 million worth of very complexly sophisticated tests that a big company did of everything from selling to marketing to merchandising to positioning to point of sale to reactivation to preservation to enhancement, to see all the variability. I did the stuff with Deming, and I got to see all kinds of variabilities and the aggregate effect of geometry. And when you, and I've done lots of things, like I helped this, I told you, litigation firm, and I saw that I could depict pain and suffering either outrageously painfully or amazingly inconsequential just by my ability to understand the psychology of the market. When you recognize the power. I mean, I remember the first thing I ever learned, that a headline, it, besides, this is back way, 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 way pre-internet, that a headline can be 80-90% of the impact, and that it can differentiate 21 times for the same cost, the same effort, the same access. I used that simple understanding to make myself millions of dollars, because I'd go and just change people's headlines, or I would change their guarantee or risk reversal, and I would get 25% of the enhancement, and I'd make hundreds of thousands of dollars a month by making the same cost, the same ad, the same direct mail do better. It was hilarious and fascinating at the same time.
that
I remember hearing one of the very first examples that I heard you talk about with that was just turning the headline two-thirds bank financing on silver and gold.
It's a true story. It made me $450,000 for about 2 hours worth of experiments, and I stopped there. I actually was lazy. If I kept doing it, I might have made $4 million because I just stopped at that headline, and that was five times. But we've tested ways of greeting people at the front door at a furniture store. One time we tested 33 different ways, and one outproduced all the rest by three times, which doesn't sound that significant until you realize that the furniture company was spending, let's call it, it doesn't matter, but let's call it $1 million a month. It was a big furniture company. They were getting a finite number of respondents to their ad, and let's call it 1,000 a month. Doesn't really matter. They were closing 150, and all of a sudden they started closing 450 plus by this one shift, just how they embraced people at the front door. It increased the average order size too by about 35%. Well, when you realize how many, I call them impact or leverage points exist that nobody even looks at. And I've learned, I'm not trying to be arrogant, but I've learned how to look at every integrative impact point, leverage point, breakthrough, breakdown that nobody even looks at, process, sub-process, because each one of them has the power of either massively multiplying or monumentally diminishing the overall result.
Wow, that's amazing. I remember Eben Pagan and I went into a Jennifer Leathers was the name of the store. Oh, and yeah, we went in, and it was amazing because they had the this unique way of greeting people, and they, instead of saying, welcome, or can I help you? No, thanks, I'm just looking. They would, in just a 20-second soundbite, say, have you been to Jennifer Leathers before? And you'd say no, and they go, well, let me tell you how it works. All the sofas that you see are available in all the leathers on the back of the wall. They're in stock and available for immediate delivery, and they're guaranteed for a year or life or whatever it was. And, I'm Susie. I'll be over here.
Yeah, it's
that great. Kind of.
It's powerful. I don't think most people, even today, I mean, and it's almost embarrassing because I know there's 9 million online tools and resources. I'll tell you the winning phrase that was that much more powerful at the furniture store, I'll tell you because it was pretty interesting. One of the things about testing, and this is where people get self-defeating because of their arrogance and their ignorance, they try to tell the market. We tried all these things. The winning phrase was, and it makes total sense afterwards, but you don't think logically. It was, and what ad brought you into the store today? And the reason in reflection why it worked was everyone else is, can I help you? Okay, even what you're saying, but think about it. If I ask you what ad brought you into the day, all of a sudden you don't have an out. You inherently and knee-jerk are going to say, well, the one for the five-piece living room suit and air suite. And then I have the ability to say, oh, is it a replacement? Is it new? What's the rest of the house? Tell me why you're doing it, and you take authoritative leadership. Leadership's a very powerful concept in marketing, and most people don't really grasp that. I'm sorry, I don't want to, step on you, but you were bringing out a thought in me. Please continue.
What you just said about leadership is really, you have been very impactful in my thinking on that, where you always say that people are silently begging to be led. And I think that unfortunately, the truth about that is that as salespeople or marketers or business owners, they're also silently waiting to be led by their customers or by their prospects.
And that's a disservice. But there's an epilogue.
Absolutely.
There's an epilogue. And you're going to see now that's the consultant side, it's stepping on you guys. But there's a little more to it. People are silently begging to be led, comma, by someone they trust has their best interests at heart. It's gotten to where it has to be amended and expanded because today most people distrust your intentions and they distrust your motives instead of trusting you. And even with full transparency with everything else, people you know, if you know, and if you've never interviewed him, you should. Stephen M. R. Covey, and you know Greg Link, obviously, but they've done seminal work on the impact of trust and trust building, and how it triples your results and cuts the timeline and enhances the longevity of buying relationship. And yet most people don't even think about, how do I create the trust that lets the prospect know that I have their best interest at heart? Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's critical too, because, you know, the number one question in all consumers' minds is, you know, who can I trust? And so part of the thing I always talk about is, you know, trust with comfort, rapport with comfort and safety. And if you can accomplish that, you know, that's where you need to be in order for people to, you know, feel chummy with you, feel comfortable with you. And the thing, Dean, you know what I'm realizing by listening to Jay? Is that I think both of our vocabularies just suck. I mean, it's just, there's no other way to say it. I mean,
I just told you, I have a love of precision. I think that, and by the way, a telephone, it to me is really, people don't, I know that video is very popular, but you paint a wonderful picture on the canvas of the mind if you can articulate very dimensional and very animated words and phrases, and you can help someone, you know, shift by doing that. And I've learned over my life that the more, not articulate, but the more dimensionally precise I am, the more I help the person grasp my point or my message, hopefully.
I got to tell you a story real quick. We just recently interviewed a friend of ours named John Benson. He's this crazy sort of bodybuilder, guy with spiked hair, and he is the inventor of the ugly video sales letter, where it's you know, like a PowerPoint presentation with words on a screen, and you know, more people are reading copy online than ever before because they're actually watching someone read copy. So. We just recently did a I Love Marketing episode, our second one that we've done with John. And he created this really cool system that helps people assemble and put together video sales letters. And I gave him a car that I bought that the company started getting in all kinds of financial trouble, Fisker, you know, the hybrid.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and I paid $116,000 for this car, and I was going to give it away as a prize, but then the company started getting into financial trouble, and I said, I can't do that in case someone, you know, doesn't have a dealership or someplace to fix it. So I gave this vehicle 2 weeks ago, at the time we're doing this this episode, to John in exchange for him writing me creating a video sales letter for me for my Genius Network, because I think he'll do a slam dunk job.
That's smart.
Yeah, and there's a couple reasons I'm bringing this up. One, I had a text message back and forth with John earlier today, and I told him, we're interviewing Jay Abraham today for I Love Marketing, and he sent back, Jay is my hero. And this is a guy who learned so much from you, and the best that they can calculate, there's been $10 billion in revenue generated with people that are using his video sales letter formula online.
That's incredible. Well, God, to tell him that I'm flattered, it's really wonderful.
Well, you'll meet him in New York, because we'll be together in New York for you speaking at the Genius Network event next week. And so you'll meet him. And the reason I bring that up is that this is a guy that really has studied words, the copy, the application of copy. And then our friend Brian Kurtz, you know, Marty Edelstein. Yeah. And, you know, they're all big believers in, you know, pay copywriters. I mean, you know, a copywriter can make you a fortune. And you obviously are a master at understanding and the application of words. And many people would, you know, I mean, they would balk at spending a few thousand dollars to have someone assemble a website or an ad or an email or a sales letter. And those people simply are ignorant because they don't know the value of it. So I wanted to just simply ask you about copy. I mean, how powerful.
Yeah, I'll give you five comments that you just spawned. The first one is, I go back to three things. I got started before the internet. We used to, one of my many, many, many careers was I was involved with a company that generated 6 million leads every year for financial institutions and everybody else. I'm going to tell you about copy, but I'm going to tell you about also flawed, non-critical thinking. People would pay us $50 to $100 for a lead, and then they try to save $8 by sending a package out, third-class mail that would take 6 weeks to deliver, and it was always fascinating to me, number one. Number two, when Gary Benzavinga was first starting, he was a fee-based copywriter, and he was charging $8,000 a package. I saw his copy and was bedazzled. I called him up, and I said, Gary, I've got a proposition. How about if you don't sell yourself to anyone, I'll pay you $4,000 up front, give you $4,000 out of the back end and half of the rest, and I'll just make it available to people for 5 cents a name, and he wouldn't do it. 5 cents, excuse me, a piece mailed, and he wouldn't do it when I was young. What I've learned about copywriting also is that people will spend a fortune to bring in. They'll pay a copywriter big money for the front end, and then they'll use a mediocre journeyman to write the internal stuff, and that's the dumbest thing in the world because you've already got the choir, and that's the stupid. You should pay through the nose because the incremental difference that you can get out of your list once you acquire them. There's just a lot of I've gotten impacted by some very profound critical thinkers, and most people are very very linear, and they're very tactical in everything they do. I mean. Increment, if you think of increment, I'm going to use a word that may not exist, but incrementalism. I always said to somebody, if I can bring you value you never would have had, why would you care if I took 99 cents out of every dollar, particularly if I can demonstrate that you're going to get most of the residual? But people are very, I mean, the reason, it's interesting. I did a treatise a couple of months ago on the concept of greatness. And it really fascinated me because every person, I think, is inherently programmed for greatness, and yet about 3% of the populace ever do anything more than mediocrity or below. And there's an irony and a tragedy to it because logic doesn't prevail. You asked me about joy. One of my great joys is that when I used to do a lot of group education, I would take the time to connect the dots for people. I'm a little old now, and it's a little more, fundamentals are not what I really do anymore. But when I was younger, I would take the time and say, let me explain logic to you, and let me explain, and then I would ask questions. Why, you know, what's wrong with this picture? And the moment you make the point for somebody, it's clearly evident, but it's like an epiphany. Epiphanies, they're nothing more than something that was always evident. It's just it's connected for you in a way where you're either somebody like me is so incessant and unrelenting and impactful that you have to submit Dorothy to it, or, you know, you're hurting enough, but I'm giving you answers that may not be what you want to hear, but those are the thoughts you spawned.
No, I like it. It's great. Well, let me ask you a couple of things based on, you know, years of experience with this and probably a lot of people that listen that make their living in the results, economy and a lot that teach business owners how to be better at marketing or do marketing for them. What are the best ways you've learned how to actually get paid for installing or advising or consulting people with marketing?
Well, I mean, when I started, I learned a couple of things. If I want to be a regular fee-based marketing consultant, I'm going to get $200 an hour. But if I want to be a performance-based marketing consultant, I might get $20,000 an hour. And to me, the risk-reward was so worth it that I learned very quickly to look for what I'll call marketing arbitrage, you know, where there's big gaps of performance, underperformance, suboptimization, as they call it. And I've always made most of my income by looking at what people were not doing, not what they were doing. Looking at, you know, I mean, it was hilarious. And you talked about Gary Halbert one time, and there's a guy, I wish I could remember his name because you know him and he's retired, but he was a very successful marketer. He used to run an insurance agency for nurses, and he came to one of the first programs I ever did, and Gary spoke, and part of our deal was a half-hour consult. And we're sitting in the bar with the guy talking. I was drinking. Gary wasn't. And the guy was sending out a million letters a year offering nurses insurance, especially insurance. And
God, I can't remember his name. It's you know who he is. I mean, I know
but
him very well.
He wasn't using a return envelope. And we said, put a return envelope in 20,000 of the next 100,000 and tell us how he did. And it tripled his response. I mean, it's just like I've learned when I was younger, I understood things like and again, I'm proud of this. I'm not saying it arrogantly. I could figure out how to get people who expired from a newsletter to stay. I could get people who stayed to upgrade. I could get people who upgraded to buy their competitor's newsletter and make a deal with the competitor where we got all the front end and half of all the renewal. I mean, I was able to do all kinds of things that most people never thought about, but I learned how to enhance every performance impact element that was marketing leverageable, but I also learned what they were, and most people didn't know any of them, and even today, most people only know a few of them.
Yeah, we got to ask you about something you've probably explained it so many times you're probably sick of it. But the three ways to grow a business, because I mean it's so fundamental. And do you still look at it the same way today as you did, you know, 20, 30 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, when I started, I realized something. You know, people say, "Oh, how many ways can you grow a business?" Well, there's a lot of tactics and a lot of techniques, but there's really three major ways, and there's a couple of more sophisticated ways. First, and the one that most people do is they spend all their time, their effort, trying to win the trust of the market. And normally they do it through external media. They'll do it through ads or pay-per-clicks or this or that. Then the second way, but you sunk most of the cost. At the point of sale, if they trust you and if you're preeminent, you got their best interests at heart and you don't want to allow them to buy whatever they want. You want them to buy what they should be buying. It's a very big environment for enhancing the quantity or the combination or the quality, all which means enhance. And the second way, first way is to get more clients, cost the most, takes the most time. Second way is to increase the size of the sale, and you can do it very nobly and very ethically. The third way is to increase the frequency or the utility of value. Frequency means exactly what it says, how often they buy. Utility means if you only sell a few things, you know, figure out other things they buy or find a front end that's lower to get more people started or a back end that's higher. Or sell the competitors if it's a market that buys lots of different things like weight loss or BizOp or things like that. And I learned that if you ain't like we have a model, it's like if you had 1,000 clients, most people don't even know how many clients they've got. They don't know categories. They don't look at anomalies and correlations. I've learned how to do all that. But if you have 1,000 clients, I'm getting a little complicated, and the average client spends $100 every time they buy and they buy twice a year, you're a $200,000 business. If you increase each of those three categories a mere 10%, and 1,000 goes to 1,100, and 100 goes to 110, and 2 goes to a mere 2.2, it does not increase the volume 10%. It's 33 and a third. If you increase each category like 25%, it's almost 300%. If you doubled each of those categories, like 800% increase. I got enraptured. I got seduced. I got lifetime hooked on the power of geometry in a business. And then as I got older, I realized you can do one more. You can add a new product every year. You can penetrate a new market every year. You can acquire on an earnout new clients. And then as I got older and more sophisticated, I realized that you can really do a lot. And it's not a way to grow a business, but I was talking about most people go to the outside market to create their client. I stopped doing that long ago. Most of my successes were totally, not detouring, but they were shortcutting. I would just go to whoever had access to the market long before affiliates and that stuff. And we did billions of dollars by me figuring out who owned the market and working out a credible way for them to make their clients our clients. And I did that industry after industry. I'm not giving you the exact answer you want, but I hope it's helpful.
No, if everyone went back and rewinded what you just said, if they had never heard that before, I mean, that is wisdom. I mean, that's truly
wisdom, and it could change someone. It will change someone's business and life if they get it and they apply it.
But Joe,
Dean, I could
more.
Ask
I mean, million.
Please.
It's different than the three ways, but in, I mean, again, I'm going through my, you're going down history, you know, and I'm shaking. I feel like the old marketer sitting on the, you know, on the front steps of the old marketer's home being nostalgic. But when I realized the power of the power Parthenon, I realized it's a whole nother dimension of adding geometry to the business. Every new access point or every new impact point or every new way that you reach the market adds another 10% or 3% or 20%, but the aggregate gets into the hundreds of percent. And that's really my ability to understand, and this is not meant arrogant, it's clinically and forensically sort of dissecting me to you and Dean and your people. I learned how to use the geometry of business building, and most people didn't understand it, and many people still don't understand it in its full majesty.
Yes. And I think what you were just describing there about looking at different ways, doing something that you're not already doing to bring people in, is an exponential improvement in that way of bringing in people, rather than trying to do the one thing that you're already doing incrementally better.
Yeah.
Well, as soon as you go from not doing something to doing something that gets a result, that's an exponential improvement in what you're doing, and it adds another pillar, as you would call it, of strengthening your Parthenon.
Yeah, when I was, again, I'm not trying to antiquate myself. When I was a young man, mm-hmm. I had so many, and this is, again, I'm just saying this so people can get excited. Not, I don't want them to think I'm an arrogant and conceited and brash person. I really have a great respect for entrepreneurship, and I love them, and I'm a great champion, and I like the human condition. But when I started doing this, we had more 10 time and 8 time, you know, we had success stories that were mm-hmm. almost unreal sounding, but it wasn't because I was that good, although I think I was pretty talented. It's because so many entrepreneurs accepted such a limited and such a restricted and such a constrained level of ongoing performance from their actions, their efforts, their activities, their access, their marketing. And we understood how to change that. And it's harder today. I'll tell you what I think today. I think today there are a myriad of generic competitors, but I don't really think there are that many viable competitors if people slow down enough to understand all the dynamics that are going on.
Mm-hmm. You mean in any market?
Yes. I think there's lots of people, lots of competitors generically, but most of them, they're just cluttering the market. They're not. Do you know Peter Drucker's definition of the difference between a proprietor and an entrepreneur?
No.
It's pretty interesting, and it has applicability, so I'm not trying to be attention deficit purposely. So
no.
Peter Drucker says the majority of small business people, which are 99% of the market, not just here, but I travel the world, it's everywhere, Japan, China, everywhere, they're proprietors. And a proprietor, his example, is literally somebody who opens up a deli in a neighborhood, and they've got a decent deli, and it's clean, and they've got decent signage, and they got a clean glass counter and a cheerful and engaging person at the counter, and they got decent wait and service people. But it's not descriptive, and it's not really distinctive, and what they're really doing is just trying to divert, you know, revenue and income from the category or the neighborhood. He said, an entrepreneur is somebody who sets out purposely before he or she even builds. This is going to be the most mind-blowing experience from the time you walk up, the signage, the look, the experience at the counter, the smell, the display, the presentation, the interaction. Everything is going to add such value, and value denominated on how the client defines value, not how the entrepreneur does, whether it's experiential, whether it's acknowledgement, whether it's just playing a beautiful havoc with your taste buds, whatever it is, but they consciously start not just with the end in mind, but with the value creation in mind, totally empathically and respectfully viewing it from the experiential eyes, ears, in this case, mouth and taste buds of the client. It's a totally different dynamic.
No, I mean, Go ahead, Dean. Keep interrupting me here, Dean, like that.
Yeah, exactly. That's the kind of thing, though, that when people hear it, that's inspiring, because you're right. Most people don't feel like that, but.
I learned preeminence from somebody else. So, I mean, there's no original thinkers. I used to say, and I'm not going to name names, one of my favorite, very prominent people in the life-changing world is not an original thinker, but he's an original synthesizer. I'm a synthesizer of all the impact and influence I've been blessed to get from so many industries. And I told you, maybe I didn't tell you, but I've done 300 experts and I had to learn all their methodology, and all that has rubbed off on me. But when I learned preeminence, the analogy that somebody made to me was, and I'll tell you two really cool things because they have influenced my marketing thinking and they relate to this. When I learned preeminence, they said, even if you are an ice cream vendor from a little stand in Central Park, you knowingly and purposely are trying for that 10 minutes that an adult stops and has the ice cream cone to bring him and her a moment of joy, a chance to nostalgically go back to their youth, an escape from the insanity of their life, and you're there to add that value. And then I met Fran Tarkenton many years ago. He was a nice friend of mine, but I met him right after he'd gone through a really interesting business reversal when he was a lot more, I think, arrogant, and he would say that. And he came out with a belief system which I have adopted, and it's anytime you ever interact with anybody in any way for any amount of time, your opportunity and your obligation and your responsibility is to make their life better off because you are in it. And that's pretty profound.
I'm sorry. I do my best to operate that way, and if I don't accomplish that, I at least want to, you know, annoy them a little bit.
I'm just giving you a philosophy, which you may not want, but you're sort of opening yourself up to it. So I apologize if it's not taking you guys in the direction you want to talk.
No. Actually, I think this is perfect. Let me ask you, like, right now, Jay, in your business, what do you feel is your highest and best use of your time? I mean, there's so many things that you could spend time on, but.
Yeah, well, I'll give you where I'm doing right now. It's sort of interesting. I'm involved in a multiplicity of activities. On one side, I don't do seminars anymore, but I do them in China, Japan, because I want to have a presence. There's an emergent, really passionate, not the knockoff pirate type, but the real qualitative people that are just hungry for guidance. And if you know what the BRICS nations are, they're all these third world nations that are very aggressive and they've got incredible focus and commitment and they interest me. So I'm involved in that. I'm involved with a very high end, activity that's designed to help, entrepreneurs who run $100 to $500 million businesses learn how to integrate convergent, divergent thinking, foresight, insight, a hindsight together, critical thinking, and it's pretty interesting. We got a book that's got a cool title. It's The CEO Who Can See Around Corners, but it teaches family-owned businesses how to stop plundering their asset value because most of them could be better off liquidating and putting the assets into a passive investment. I'm involved, because I like it, with one of the guys from Shark Tank in stuff for startup entrepreneurs, but it's like a labor of love, and I'm very interested in the crowdfunding business because I think it's going to be like a madhouse of opportunistic people. And if you can bring qualitative thinking to both investors and people who are vying for the investment, and you can enhance their success, that's interesting. But my mainstay is still really, and Joe, you and I have talked about it a lot, I prefer not being intellectual entertainment. I want to be involved with real commerce. I want companies that are doing 10, 50, 100 million to let me get involved with them. And in masterminding, you know, their marketing, their strategy, their business model, their, you know, their, you know, their revenue approach, their preemptive, preeminent distinction, their, you know, their market access, their marketing. And I want to share, yeah, I like fee income, but I'd much rather get very low fees and get very high participation in the results I engineer, because that's what I've always done. But I like a lot of stuff. I spend over 2 hours a day not earning money, but multiplying my knowledge. I have a cadre of people who are much brighter than I, representing a broad spectrum. And you do this, Joe, of areas, professions. And we talk, you know, once a week or once every 2 weeks, depending on the person. And I listen more. Right now I'm talking because I presume that's what you want from me. But most of the time I learned that you learn a lot more by asking very probative Socratic. I learned Socratic interviewing, and it's basically one of the most powerful gifts you can give to somebody, is to learn how to ask probative penetrating questions and learn how to track the answer and keep going deeper and deeper and reflect. Also, I learned that when you're done with a conversation, don't go on to the next one. Stop. Spend 10 or 15 minutes reflecting. What did I learn from that other person that I don't possess and that I can gain from? What did I do that I'm not very proud of that I could improve? What different way of looking at life or slant came from that? What, you know, and most people, just they're just going through life in a zombified way.
Mm. Yeah. No, I love it. You know, before I forget, I should probably have you define preeminence, the strategy of preeminence, just in case anyone's not clear on that.
Okay, I'll give you the short one. It takes about 2 or 3 hours to really fully embed it. But basically, it's distinguishing yourself as the most trusted advisor for life in the mind's eye of the market target that you're after. It's having the commitment to lead people. It's not providing information, but providing, you know, the most well-reasoned, well-researched, meaningful and valuable advice. It's, as you said, not falling in love with your product, your service, your company, but falling in love with your clients. And there's four kind of clients: the ones who pay you and the ones you pay, the clients that are your buyers, certainly, but you want to fall in love with your team. You want to grow them. You want to develop them. You want to have your vendors be your greatest allies and partners and collaborators and your stakeholders. It's about basically not allowing people to buy less than they should, and less quantity than they should, and less frequency, quality than they should, not because you're going to make more money, but because if they don't, they're going to get a lesser outcome. It's about not letting them not buy, and not letting them buy from the competitor, not because the competitor's a jackass, but because the competitor isn't going to add the value you do, and you know that if they don't act, they're going to be lessened in the quality or the protection. I can go on and on and on and on and on. It's about being able to think about the transactional impact of your product or service at work in the life of the client. And the best example is not if you're selling a computer, you'd say, well, it's a commodity. I wouldn't. I'd be able to think about that computer helping, you know, enhance their ability to communicate, to, you know, to operate their business. It's having the ability to transcend superficiality and thinking. It's about having the most heartfelt level of empathy, figuring out, being able to genuinely know what it's like to be the recipient, having an appreciation, an understanding, a respect, a context of really understanding how that person sees life. It's about being able to verbalize and articulate their most heartfelt desires and fears in ways they've never put into words. And go on and on and on and on and on, because I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. But that's a good introduction.
Yeah, I mean, if someone was intentional and decided to actually do their business that way, it would change everything. It would, if not only for them, but for their clients. And I mean,
you,
I think
know
that's
this. I mean, I'm very proud, and I got to say this, and I'm going to run out of time, but I have had the very good fortune of teaching the depth of this, and then not just teaching it theoretically, but being able to work with clients and evolve it and instill it and install it and dimensionalize it and and then inculcate it into all the people that they currently work and turn into their culture and make it part of their marketing and make it part of their communication and make it a natural part of their life. And honestly, that's why I've been able to generate so many success stories at such a distinctive way, because most people are mediocre. Most people are superficial. Most people are self-consumed. Most people are focused on the wrong thing. Only because I'm going to run out of time, what else can I answer for you?
Well, we'll go a couple minutes over, but I've got one last question, Dean, and one short thing I want to say. Then I want to ask Jay what he recommends for people to learn more from him, what of his materials, where they can learn more about him, read any of his books he suggests. But yeah, I just want to don't step on your toes. So, Dean.
No, perfect. You're asking a lot of the things I would have asked, so this is great.
Okay, so let me ask you this then, Jay. You know, what do you feel is either the keys or the key to succeeding in business and in life? Because you've met so many rich, miserable people and so many wealthy, happy people. You've met people that have made impact. You've made tons of successes for yourself and others, and I'm sure you've had mountains of things that didn't go well. So what do you think are some of the keys?
Because I got started when I was 18, and I'm now 64, I've had three midlife crises, 40, 50, and at 60, because, what's it all about, Alfie? And I spent, because I could afford it, a lot of money on therapy. And I would never buy anybody for 45 minutes. I'd buy them for a whole week. And it was hilarious because if I was too busy, I would send somebody in my life that was screwed up who would never have the willingness or the money to go there. But I spent a lot of time asking a lot of questions and listening to the answers. And I got one clarity. It's going to answer what your question is, that I think is the meaning of business life and the meaning of life. And one of the guys, very profound guy, said to me, most people are obsessed in their life, in their business, in their career with the end product. They want to be the most successful. They want the fastest growing company. They want the most money. They want the prettiest wife. They want the biggest house. He said, if they're unlucky enough to get that for that reason alone, their delusion will be broken, because the sky's not going to open. The angels aren't going to trumpet. Euphoria is not going to rain down on them. They're not going to gain happiness, and it's not going to be all rosy. It's going to be anticlimactic. He said that life is nothing more than the process. This conversation is as good as it gets, and it's stimulating. But if you were the janitor, like, it'd be just as important. When we go to China and Japan, we always go early, and we spend the first day riding on the elevators for 4 or 5 hours and sitting in the lobby, making it a point to smile and engage people until they finally break a smile, and you can see their body language change. And it's just like it's enjoying the process. And being so externally focused that you're connected and understanding your market perhaps better than they understand themselves. I mean, you probably know my Amazon.com school of business theory, don't you?
No. Actually, no. No, I don't.
Cool. It's before I ever want to address a market, I go to Amazon.com and look at every book in the category or derivative categories, and I go to every online community. And I look at the divisiveness. I look at all the five rankings on the book. First, I look at the titles and the subtitles. I want to know what resonates to people. So I got language patterns. Then I want to look at all the reviews that are either fives or fours or zeros, because when you're passionate can be happy and passionate can be unhappy. Your subconscious takes over and your natural feelings articulate. People express what they like, what they don't like in the most dimensional and sincere, authentic, and insightful way. And I want to know how people's subconscious mind really works. I don't think anyone really, I've read so much copy in the halcyon days of online information marketing that was so superficial with hype and bullets, and nobody really understood the mind, the hopes, the dreams, the frustrations. They didn't really try to. They just wanted to basically monetize people. I think it's caring. I think it's caring enough to understand. Because when you understand someone and you demonstrate empathically and verbally that you get them, then that creates trust. And trust is, it's the bridge to prosperity for both entrepreneurs and the recipient, the clients. It's the bridge to, you know, connectivity. It's everything. So I don't know if that answer helps, but there's my answer.
No, that's very good. That's very good. And before we wrap up, I have to mention about, I have a friend, JR, and, he's a former Make-A-Wish kid, and his wish was to meet you. He had a kidney transplant, and I'm sure you remember that, Jay. And, you know, JR listens to all of our, I Love Marketing podcasts. We've actually even interviewed him, and he's read every single thing that you have ever written, and I think he's watched and consumed pretty much everything you've produced that he could get his hands on. And I think it's so cool that when he was young that he actually wanted to meet, you know, Jay Abraham.
That was very, I was impacted by that. And it was gratifying, but it was really, I tell you, when we used to do the very expensive seminars, I'm talking about the $15,000, $20,000 ones 20 years ago, I was really impacted by the entrepreneurs who paid to bring their 18-year-old kids. And it was really, I took the responsibility extraordinarily seriously because you had a chance to transform that person's life at a formative age. But yeah, it's good. It only because I've got somebody upstairs waiting for me. I hope this has been useful for your listeners.
Yeah, well, let's do this. Absolutely. So people want to learn from you. They want to follow any of your stuff, anything you recommend. Where's the best place for people to that have never been introduced to
Abraham.com. We don't sell. I mean, most of the stuff I give away, you know, we sell, you know, something that's got like 30 seminars on it, but I don't really try to sell stuff. I've got resources we give away and, you know, they can go there and there's tons of, you know, there's hours and hours and I'm in a different place at this point in my life. But yeah, go to Abraham.com and if you want to learn about preeminence, I think if you look up, you know, the strategy, we've got 5 or 7 hours of preeminence somewhere on my website. I don't even know. And we got applications of, and we got case studies, and we got like 700 pages of case studies, and we got stuff on great. And I got stuff all over the place, but there's a lot of stuff there, but I don't sell very much anymore, but they can go there. There's lots of, you know, there's hours and hours, hundreds of hours and thousands of pages, and have at it because it's my pleasure. I'm a great champion of the beleaguered entrepreneur, but I'm a greater admirer of the preeminent entrepreneur.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we're all going to be together next week in New York for the Genius Network annual event. Jay and both of you are going to be giving stellar, amazing talks. And so, on behalf of myself and Dean, thank you, Jay. Anything else you want to say, Dean?
Yeah, thank you, Jay. It's been great.
Yeah, it's awesome. So everyone, give us your comments, and let us know what you think, and check out Jay's website and read his stuff because it will change your life. So thank you so much, Jay.
Very welcome, guys.
Awesome. Thanks.